other, many of the books of the Old Testament.
Right. So we looked at Esther and all the allusions to elsewhere in the Bible, and the fact that the author of Esther deliberately leaves God out, explicit mention of God out, and prayer, and all things like that. However, all these allusions to elsewhere in the Bible do seem to prove that it was, in fact, in his mind, God and everything it entails. So we looked at Esther and Saul, and we looked at specific words and literary links that connect the two. So from the beginning of the scroll, we're set up to see Esther as a sort of second Saul. She's a Benjamite, and here she's come to royalty, and she was very obedient and very secretive about her ancestry in the beginning, and we compared that word to be silent, how Saul, when he's first made king, is silent, and Mordecai charges Esther with that same word. If you remain silent, i.e. like your ancestry, God's going to use someone else. And so if you want to step up and redeem your family line, you can do it, but you're going to have to act. And Esther understands all those messages. We have a laugh. Oh, okay. We also mentioned that there are parallels elsewhere in the Bible to the whole Saul and David stories. But we said that today we were going to look specifically at the parallels to Amalek, because I think that's a parallel you can't read Esther without seeing. And that's the parallel that flavors the whole scroll. So, because the story of Amalek is less familiar to us, I'd like us to read it quickly together. It's only 9 verses. It is in Exodus 17, verse 8 to 16. Exodus 17, verses 8 to 16. Who would like to read for us?
8 to 17?
8 till the end of the chapter, 16.
The Amalekites came and attacked the Israelites at Rephidim. Moses said to Joshua, "Choose some of our men and go out to fight them. Tomorrow I will stand on top of the hill with the staff of God in my hands." So Joshua fought the Amalekites as Moses had ordered. And Moses, Aaron, and Hur went to the top of the hill. As long as Moses held up his hands, the Israelites were winning. But whenever he lowered his hands, the Amalekites were winning. When Moses' hands grew tired, they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it. And Aaron and Hur held his hands up, one on one side, one on the other, so that his hands remained steady till sunset. So Joshua overcame the Amalekite army with a sword. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Write this on the scroll as something to be remembered, and make sure that Joshua hears it, because I will completely erase the memory of the Amalekites from under heaven." Moses built an altar and called it, "The Lord is my banner." He said, "My hands were lifted up to the throne of the Lord. The Lord will be at war against the Amalekites from generation to generation."
He said, "Hands are lifted up." Is that what your text says?
"For hands were lifted up to the throne of the Lord."
Interesting. What translation do you have?
Mine's the same in New International.
"For hands were lifted up."
In New International.
Wow.
Are you contesting that?
Sure.
It's 10 hours.
I'll tell you what it says. "Vayomer ki yad al kesya milhama l'Adonai ba'amalek midor dor." And we're going to be discussing that verse because it's very ambiguous, let's say. It's very unclear what this means. And there have been numerous interpretations. And even within the Bible, it seems to be there are several interpretations of this verse. it's almost poetic. So when you come to poetry, it can have two meanings at the same time. And that's the beauty of it. But let's look at other things I want to draw your attention to. Why? Look at verse 8. What is Amalek's motive for attacking?
Unknown,
did you say? That's right. It doesn't give us any motive. They just attack out of the blue. And if you've been putting this in your mind in context, the children of Israel have just crossed the sea. They've just wandered through the desert and needed water that the Lord provided. And this is the first time we have an enemy attacking them.
I think that they've heard about Israel from all that what happened in Israel. They said, well, we're going to get them before they get us or something.
Maybe they heard about Israel. If you look back, that's a nice comment. Look back in the Song of the Sea, Exodus 15. What happens when all the nations hear about Israel? Look in Exodus 15:14. The nations heard and
trembled.
Fear seized the dwellers of Pelesheth. Then they were afraid, the leaders of Edom, okay, the Edomites and the Moabites, they're shaking with fear.
Terrified.
Right. So theoretically, these guys should be shaking with fear. But here they are attacking the Israelites.
But it follows on from the Israelites quarreling because they tested the Lord, saying, is the Lord among us or not?
Exactly.
This is the immediate response that the Amalekites then think, ha ha.
Right. God, well, right, here's the other thing to note. In our story, is God mentioned?
In the Amalekite story?
Only at the end.
Right.
After the war, Moses thanks God and he builds an altar and calls it, God is my standard of war.
You want me to understand?
I don't know. But go back in the room. And the only way, Moses never receives a command, hey, take the rod and go up to the top of the hill. So the only way we understand what's going on here is by looking at the context before and after. And the story before, as Gemma brought up, is about water from the rock. And the Lord says to Moses, I'm going to be over there on the mountain at Horeb. And you come and, you know, beat the rock and it will make water for the people of Israel. And God uses the word, here I am standing before you. Here I am going before you. He says, here I am standing on the rock. You go before the children of Israel. So Moses and Aaron and the leaders are all on their way to Horeb to get water. And then it explains the place name, Masau Meriva, because they doubted, is God really with us? And so immediately after, here comes Amalek. And so we can understand from the context that the attack of Amalek is in some way a response to that last verse of doubt. Is God really with us? And then, hey, you don't think God's with you? Well, I'll show you when God's not with you. This is what's going to happen when you doubt, Amalek attacks. And then we have a scientific experiment, so to speak. If you look at the wording, when Moses would raise his hand, Israel wins. When he would lower it, Amalek wins. That means it wasn't just one time up. It was like this. When he raised his hand, like a light switch, they're winning. Okay, so now God's with you, you're winning. Now he's not. It's like very clear evidence. But nowhere so far is God even mentioned. The other thing to look at, if you're just looking at our story, is that Amalek really has no motive of his own. God can be using him and allow him to attack, to kind of challenge the people's lack of faith. But Amalek himself has to have a motive, and he doesn't have a good one. It doesn't say they came to Amalek territory, right? There's no water involved. Israel hasn't done anything to them. So in that sense, Amalek is a picture in the Bible of the original anti-Semite, to use an anachronism. In this case, anti-Israelite.
But aren't the Amalekim the traditional desert vagabonds?
You could say that too. They're desert vagabonds. They don't really have one place. However, we do have a place name in Genesis 14, Sde Amaleki, the field of the Amalekites. And we have a Ir Amalek, which some people contest is actually, city of Amalek, which could actually be Har Amalek, or a mountain of Amalek. So there are some places associated with the Amalekites.
And we don't know how populous they were. No sign.
We know nothing about them other than what these stories tell us. Outside of the Bible, there is no proof they ever even existed.
Yeah.
So
400 young camel drivers.
They are, though, if you notice in the song we read, they are one of the people of the Edomites. They are the bastard child of the Edomites. So
how big was the army of Moses?
How big was the army of Moses? Well, all the
because
people of Israel.
Okay, so that's like millions.
I don't know, because he told Joshua, choose out men. We don't know how many. We don't know how many men Joshua chose. Yeah. And we don't know how big Amalek is. But there's certainly a power, because at the end of the verse, your translation of verse 13, Vayahalosh Yoshua et Amalek. Joshua weakened Amalek. It actually is using an intransitive verb transitively. But the point is, they're using, he weakened him. There are those who want to interpret this as defeated based on Arabic cognates. But I don't think that's the case, because out of like four or five times that this verb comes in the Bible, it's contrasted with gavar, which is to be strong, to overcome. And that's exactly the word we find when Moses' hands are up. Israel gover, it's stronger, it's winning.
We're 13. So we get the verse Joshua overcame, and that's the word you're saying.
Yes, that's the word I'm saying is he weakened.
He weakened.
He did. I mean, obviously there was some form of victory because Moses builds an altar, but it was more like a, we've managed to hold them off kind of thing. It wasn't, yay, we defeated them. And that's why you have verse 16, God has an eternal war with Amalek. So if they were completely defeated, why would you need an eternal war? Who are, you know? Now, so that's one thing to note. We have it written in a book for memory and told orally to Joshua that God speaking says, wiping out, I will surely wipe out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. And memory there you could interpret as several things. His name, his progeny, like their sons. And that's when Moses builds his altar.
I always get confused with that, because in this version, NIV, I've got, I will completely blot out the name of Amalek, fine. And then the two verses on, he says, the Lord will be at war against the Amalekites from generation to generation.
Yeah, so
you've got this.
How can it be ongoing if it's going to be final?
I mean, yeah, if he's really blotted them out. I mean, I guess the weakening bit makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But if he's really blotted them out, as it says in the next verse, then how come God's going on remembering?
Right. And how can it be a generation-to-generation thing?
That's right. I mean, I've always understood Amalek to be like the sort of, you know, personification of Satan or something, that he's always there.
Well, maybe that's what it means, that from generation to generation, therefore Amalek can't. He's not going to be able to say, oh God, please forgive me, please take this away, don't let them fight us forever. But because he's blotting them out, they will fight him forever.
It's not
going to totally annihilate them, like, from the face of the earth. They're going to have babies and continue on, but they're never going to be able to not have war with Israel or something.
Well, it's a very intriguing question, and that's why one of the reasons verse 16 is so mysterious. Amalek, if you look at the whole Bible, You will not find one positive thing about him. Contrast to Edomites. At the beginning, we have verses in Deuteronomy. Don't despise the Edomite because he's your brother. Right? Now, if you look at after exile, all the books of the Bible written after exile have nothing good to say about Edom because he played a part in the southern kingdom falling to the Babylonians. So from that point on, everyone just has basically non-blessings to give them. But within the biblical literature, you have both positive and negative sides. And it's that way, you know, the Moabites. Moabites are those terrible people who seduce Israel. However, look at Ruth. And look how she redeems Moabites. And so I think every other people group that are a real people group and not just one of the seven that kind of disappear somewhere, they all seem to have something that redeems them, and Amalek alone does not. And so this has actually led to the interpretation that Amalek, it's not so much wiping out the physical Amalek, whoever they may have been, but it's the attitude that Amalek represents, his spirit in attacking Israel for no reason, just to wipe them out. And so that same spiritual attitude can come in every generation. And so that's what needs to be wiped out. Because it's so black and white, and God has mercy on everyone, so what's going on? So that was one interpretation, that it's not so much a people group, or maybe it started with an original people group, but it has a spiritual genealogy more than a physical one. It's a prototype, yeah.
Yeah, like the people. If let's say you were born into that, and you really don't, you really figure that this is a wicked people, you can get out of it. I mean, but it's not that's the same thing as this is all of Israel will be saved.
Yeah.
You know, we know that not every human person that was born Jewish is going to be saved. You know, but you know.
Yeah. So it's still though a very curious text to understand. And if we direct our attention now to verse 16, it literally said, and he said, this is after Moses names the altar, God is my banner. And he said, for a hand on the throne of Yah, there is war, God has war with Amalek from generation to generation. And actually, if you read literally, midor dor, since time immemorial is one way you could translate that. But if you understand it to be midor ledor, it's from generation to generation. So that's kind of, I think, how we're meant to understand it, since this is the first story dealing with Amalek. So this becomes the precedent that influences the way we read future stories that refer to Amalek. But what does it mean that there's a hand on the throne? There is no verb mentioned. So people have had to understand this word picture. One of the interpretations is that a hand is swearing on the throne of a god. And whose hand is it? Is it God's hand? Is it Moses' hand? Is it Israel's hand? Is it Amalek's hand? And that...
Just read it in Hebrew. That can you do that first?
Vayomer ki yad al kestia. Milhama l'Adonai ba'amalek midor dor. So a hand on, and also the word kesya, it only comes here. What is a kes? People fill it in to be kise, which is the word for throne. And kise, with God's name, kise Adonai, comes like twice in the Bible, once in Jeremiah 3, where it refers to Jerusalem being God's throne. But at this point, we're not talking about Jerusalem yet, so... The other place, it's where Solomon, let's see, 1 Chronicles, I think it's 1 Chronicles 29, 1 Chronicles 29:13, if I remember right. Let's just jump there and see. Maybe 23, yeah. 1 Chronicles 29:23. Solomon sat on the Lord's throne as king in place of his father David. He was successful and all Israel was loyal to him. So if you want to hear that in Hebrew, Vayeshev Shlomo al Kisei Adonai. Because it's the full name, I'm reading with the tradition, you don't say God's full name. If it were shortened, the shortened version of God's name is Yah. So this is roughly equivalent. Instead of Kes, we have Kiseh. Instead of Yah, we have God's full name. So that's 1 Chronicles 29:23. So who's sitting on God's chair here? God's throne? Solomon, who is the king of Israel. So this is also interesting in how you interpret our little passage back in Exodus. So not only whose hand is, what the hand is in question, but what this chair or throne is, how you interpret that, and what the hand is doing. So really, everything in the verse is in question. That's what makes it.
Doesn't it get interpreted in a positive way, really? It's Moses who's had his hands up,
right,
in intercession.
It doesn't say intercession, but you're saying that's the interpretation.
Okay,
yeah.
I'm interpreting.
Yeah.
Okay. His hands up, presumably towards the throne of the Lord in intercession. That's how I understood it. And that was what made them win.
However, okay, so you're interpreting the key to be because a hand was towards God's throne, God has an eternal war with Amalek.
Because of their faithfulness, or I guess I've always understood it to mean that God, because of, if we are dependent on God for the victory, God will defeat Amalek.
Right. Well, I agree with the overall interpretation. The problem there is that the two halves of the verse don't really line up then.
Right.
If, because there was a hand towards God's throne, refers to this specific incident, because of that, God has an eternal war with Amalek? You could also translate the key whenever, like for a hand of the Lord is on the throne. But none of that would explain the second half very well, which has been a problem in interpretation. But yeah, the people basically have said something similar in Moses swearing on God's throne, or God swearing on his own throne that he will surely wipe them out. He has an eternal war.
I was just looking back, also the staff was in his hands, and wasn't that an anointing and a power and a strength of the Lord, as well as the hands and the staff?
Well, there's two things. One verse says there's a staff in the hand. The other verse just has his hands up and down. So presumably his staff's in one hand, and his hands are going up and down.
I think that has a big thing to do with it, because Moses said, tomorrow I will stand on top of the hill with the rod
of God in my hand. Exactly.
I mean, he made a point of...
So from Moses' perspective, that is what's going on. When the people see his hands raised with a rod, they can look to God. Or you have a comment?
Could it be just it's a matter of faith? Because there's already an ongoing war with the evil one. He's already brought down God's throne. So in the sense of Eden, you know, Adam and Eve.
Yeah.
So that is going on. And so before, they've always followed God. And whenever the people revolted, there would be a problem. But in this case, it's faith to have his hand up, but if he drops it.
Right, so it can be faith to have your hand up.
That wouldn't enter in at all had they not been doubting.
Right, right. It certainly is a picture of faith to have the hands up, because if you look at the words, after this has been going on for a while, Aaron and Hob come and help Moses, and it says, and his hands were faith until the sunset. Well, that's what it says in Hebrew, but they're using a word, emunah, that normally means faith or faithfulness, actually. But in the context, it's clear they're talking about physical faithfulness, and the two are connected in Hebrew. To be ne'eman is to be faithful. It can also mean physically solid, like dependable. So they're kind of playing off both meanings here. They're saying Moses' hands remained up, like that, remained up. However, they're implying, by using the word emunah, they're hinting that there's a faith thing going on.
Because the Psalms all day, to lift your hands lifted up, praising God, giving glory to God, and the hands are lifted.
Right.
Well, this is God's battle, you know.
Right. Yeah. And so this contrasts with the doubt in the previous chapter, that Moses is being faith for the people, basically. And that would tie in to the last verse. There's another interesting interpretation when it says Ki Yad Al Kesia. If we remember to Moses talking to God at the burning bush, he asked God to send another person instead of him. And in Hebrew he says something like Shlach Beyad Asher Tishlach. Send another Yad, another hand. And that's just an idiom for saying another person. So another interpretation of this verse has been, when there is a person on the throne of God, and if you think of the Chronicles passage, that would be when there is a king on the throne of God. Like, throne of God is throne of Israel in that interpretation. So when we get a king, God's going to have war with Amalek. And this interpretation is found in very old sources in the Aramaic. Not the official Aramaic translation, which is Onkelos, comes from the east. Well, it was used in Babylon. The other, what they call Palestinian Targums, because they're from this land, they tend to include more interpretation into their translation. And they specifically state a king. And there's Midrash on this. There's further interpretation that the reason it says Ket and not Kiseh is that God's throne can only be complete when Amalek gets blotted out. And this is going to happen when the future king sits on the throne. And so, who is the future king of Israel when you're here in Exodus 17? Tell me. Or flip to 1 Samuel 15. Saul. Vayomer Shmuel el Shaul. Samuel said to Shaul, Oti shalach Adonai limshochacha lemelech alamo. God has sent me to anoint you king over his people. And what? Look in verse 3. So let's start in verse 2. Thus said the Lord. I'm in 1 Samuel 15, verse 2. After Samuel has just been anointed king, and he says, thus says the Lord of hosts, I remember what Amalek did to you that he ambushed you on the way coming up out of Egypt.
Mine says waylaid, like put them back.
Okay, waylaid. Somewhere. It says Samlo, he put him. Now, 1 Samuel 15, verse 2. The first verse is where he gets anointed king. Second and third verse, he's going to get his first commandment as what he should do as a king. And the preamble is God saying, I remember what Amalek did to you as you were coming up out of Egypt. Now, verse 3. Go, strike Amalek and obliterate him. Obliterate everything that he has. Don't have mercy on him. From man to woman, little kid, baby, ox, sheep, camel, donkey, everything.
And how much time between Moses and Saul?
I don't know. A long time.
Hundreds of years?
The point is that this is the first king.
The Malachites are still going, I assume.
Yeah, the Malachites have been around.
A lot of years later.
A lot of years. And here's Saul, and he gets his first injunction as king, and it's to wipe out Amalek. So, this may in fact be an interpretation of Exodus 17. When a king sits on the throne, wipe out Amalek. Also, another key text that will inform us is Deuteronomy 25. Chapter 25, 17 through 19. And of course, all these texts are going to be read on Purim. Remember what Amalek did to you on the way when you left Egypt, which is similar wording to what we saw in 1 Samuel 15. That he happened upon you on the way, and that's not a good happening. And he tailed you and all the stragglers in your rear. And you were tired and weary and not fearing God. Now look at verse 18. I just read you my translation. There's a phrase that says Ve'ata, and he's talking to Israel. Ve'ata ayef ve'yagea ve'lo yare Elohim. You're tired, weary, and not fearing God. A lot of people want to take that last phrase, ve'lo yare Elohim, not fearing God, and pop it back way up to Amalek. But I think he's actually talking to Israel. And
it's the same time up as before.
And I think
they'd be moaning and complaining because they couldn't get whatever.
Exactly. I think Deuteronomy is giving us a more explicit interpretation of Exodus 17. Like, hey, remember the story before you were complaining? To fear God is just to believe that he's there watching you, to believe that he's with you. So when the people said, hey, is God really with us? That is not fearing God. That's a lack of faith. And so
again,
here,
he says, blot them out. Every time he says,
yes.
And they didn't.
So he says, don't you remember what Amalek did to you? So this is a bit of a double injunction, because you're remembering not only did Amalek attack you when you didn't fear God, but you're also remembering that God remembers the evil thing that Amalek did. So although in a sense Amalek was punishing them, also what he did wasn't good. And so he's going to get punished. And so the next verse says, look at verse 19 of Deuteronomy 25. And it will be when God gives you rest from all your enemies around in the land that he will give you as an inheritance to inherit, you will wipe out the memory of Amalek from under the heaven. Don't forget. So there's a subtle change here between Exodus 17:14's verse, where God says, I will surely wipe him out. Now he's saying, hey, don't forget, you will wipe him out. So there's a little bit of a, wait, who's going to wipe him out, God or us? And there's, again, that tension, like who's the one at work?
You're not leading up to their Iran, are you?
No.
Who are they now?
No, I wasn't, actually. I'm trying to lead up to Esther.
No, but I think, like, when Moses was holding up his hands, and we established that with God's paddle, at least in my head.
Yes, God's power.
But he uses those people, those soldiers, to carry out the work.
Right.
And so as he's saying that you will wipe them out, but it's really his battle.
It's really his battle. And the beauty of it is there's no miracle in the standard sense of miracle. There's no hail that comes down. There's no fire from heaven. There's just a battle. And the only way you know that it's God at work is that the people were preserved in the end. And they were able to come. Remember, they were right on their way. This is the last stop right before they get the law. They're literally in the valley underneath Mount Horeb, according to the layout Exodus gives us. Because God already says, I'm going in front of you. I'm going to be standing on Horeb, and you're going to hit the rock there. So it's right after that Amalek attacks. So Moses is trying to get water for the people. Everyone's still tired, and Amalek attacks them. So in a sense, that adds to his evilness. Like, he's trying to cut them off before they will make this binding covenant with God and have kind of God's blessing. So Saul gets his first injunction, go back and wipe out Amalek. Does he do it?
No.
No. Why not? He spares the king Agag and the best of the flock. Of course, to give a sacrifice to God, right? And God says, and he also fears the people. In his answers to Samuel, he says, the people basically asked me to do this. And so Samuel says the famous lines, doesn't God desire obedience more than sacrifice? Like, you were supposed to obey. That's the first thing. So what happens as a result of Saul's disobedience here? Well, let's keep to Saul first. He gets the kingdom taken away, ultimately. And Samuel kills the king then, because Saul didn't. And the king of Amalek, what's his name? We find out in verse 8. Look at verse 8 of 1 Samuel 15. Agag. Right. So Saul essentially loses, this is his first big foray, basically, and he loses his kingship right from the very beginning. It's gradually pulled away, it's not an immediate thing, but the decisive moment was his disobedience in regards to Amalek. So now, let's go to Esther. And we've talked a lot last week about Esther's introduction paralleling King Saul. And so now we're going to look at chapter 3, verse 8. Okay, wait, was it verse 7? Oh, I guess at the beginning of the chapter. I'm looking for Haman's introduction. Okay, the king promoted Haman. It's actually a by-the-way introduction, but look at, sorry, it's verse 1 of chapter 3. Esther 3, verse 1. Sometime later, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedata, the Agagite, exalting him and setting his position. Oh, too bad. His position above all the other officials.
I've got giving him a seat of honor.
There you go.
So we're back at your throne.
We're back at the throne, exactly. He put his chair above everybody else. That's what it says. Seat of honor, throne, whatever you want to translate there. But the parallel is there. Achar dvarim ha'ele, gidal ha'melech ahashverosh et haman ben hamedata ha'agigi, v'aynasehu v'ayasam et kis'o, his chair, his throne. Na'al kol asarim asher ito. Okay, so we learn two things here. Who is Haman? He's Ben Hammedata. And what is he? An Agagite. So somehow, the author of Esther is saying, this guy comes from Agag. So that makes the whole war with Amalek instantly relevant for our reading of the scroll. And so when we see these other hints, we should be thinking about this original encounter with Amalek. And one of the ways we can see that, there's a whole theme in Esther of up and down. And it is funny. I mean, we're talking about Amalek, and it's kind of a very serious thing. But the way the scroll of Esther is telling you the story is also very funny. He's using a technique of burlesque, where you describe very serious matters very flippantly. And so we have a picture of a puppet king. We have Haman and Mordechai, and they're going up and down. If you think of the original battle with Amalek, for Israel to be up, what must happen? I mean, Moses' arms are up, and Israel's up. Where's Amalek? Presumably, down. And when it switches, Amalek's up and Israel's down. So you have this mutual exclusivity with Amalek. If Amalek's up, it means Israel's down. If Israel's up, Amalek is down. And so this plays out with Haman and Mordechai's relationship. If Haman's going to be up, Mordechai is not. If Mordechai is up, Haman's down. Even to the point where Haman, in the very beginning of the scroll, this is the one everyone remembers, what really gets to him about Mordechai? Why does he think he needs to make this plan to wipe out all of Mordechai's people?
Because he won't bow down.
He won't bow down, and says he won't bow down or prostrate himself before Haman. However, later on in the scroll, what bothers him? Look in Esther 5:13. He's telling his friends how he got invited to the queen, and that's this great honor. But, verse 13, all of this fails to satisfy me so long as I have to see Mordechai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. Now it's bothering him. Mordechai is sitting down. Why?
Because he
Right.
It's like he's sitting on the seat. I mean, you should either be on your face presumably in front of the king or on your knees in front of Haman. But
or
sitting,
at the gate didn't have chairs.
There's also, I think there's another verse I'm not finding here too. That, well, I'll just read it here. That he is sitting as opposed to standing for him. Okay, here. In Esther 5:9. Haman went out that day happy and in good spirits. And as Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, he didn't get up. Mordecai didn't get up and he didn't move from him. And so Haman got furious. He was filled with fury. All right, so what's bothering Haman? Mordecai didn't stand up for him. Isn't that a little strange? He's bothered that he doesn't bow down, and now he's bothered he doesn't stand up.
Oh, I see.
I get attention. Yeah, like you. Clearly, there's no winning here. And so you still have this mental picture of up and down, up and down. The first time Haman goes and consults with his wife and advisors, this is in chapter 5 we're looking, verse 14, when he says, you know, Mordecai the Jew is sitting at the king's gate and presumably not standing, and that's getting to him. And so Zeresh comes up with the idea, have a big, huge, this says gallows, but a big, huge tree or big, huge stick.
Pole.
Okay, erect a big pole and hang him on it. Presumably skewer him, impale him on it. And the word for hanging is used for both, impaling. And we actually know that these guys impaled people. So, and then go to the banquet and be contented. So he built that. Now the second time, when he goes back after the banquet and he wants some more encouragement, what does his wife say? Remember, he wanted to go ask the king if he could hang Mordecai, and the king just happened to have insomnia and remember Mordecai's good deed to him, and so he wants to honor this person.
In 6:13, his wife says, "Since Mordecai, before whom your downfall has started, is of Jewish origin, you cannot stand against him. You will surely come to ruin."
Right, which is very interesting. Before, he already mentioned that Mordechai was a Yehudi, but I guess no one was listening then. But now, after he's had to parade Mordechai the Yehudi around the whole city, Zeresh makes that statement. And she does say, because he is from the Zera of the Yehudim, the seed of the Jews, that you have begun to fall before him, you cannot overcome him. Lo tuchalo. You're not able against him. Ki nafol tipol lefanav. For you will, falling, you will surely fall before him. So again, they're using an imagery of falling, and you've begun to fall before him. And then, ironically, part of that ultimate fall is to be exalted way up on the own gallows he built, or this large pole. However, this exaltation is surely not for honor, it is for shame. So you see a lot of playing in the Scroll of Esther with this up and down motif and mutual exclusivity between Haman and Mordechai. And as soon as we hang or skewer Haman, all his things get transferred to Mordechai. So in that sense, there's a takeover. But since we only have a couple more minutes, other things that relate to the Battle of Amalek. The whole need to completely destroy. Here in Esther, it's in a response to having a decree to completely destroy the Jews. But there is, in the reporting of all these battles, it's very interesting that the author points out three times. Look in verse, in chapter 9, starting with verse 10. Aseret b'nei Haman, the 10 kings of Haman, were killed, but the biza, the plunder, they didn't put their hands into the plunder. So the Jews did not take plunder. And then in verse 15, all the Jews got together in Shushan on the 14th day of the month, and they killed in Shushan 300 men, but they did not plunder them. And then look in verse 17. Where is it? Oh, sorry, verse 16. But they did not plunder them. So three mentions that they did not take plunder. Why is this significant?
That must tie up then again with Saul.
With Saul.
He did not kill Agag, but he did take the plunder.
He took the plunder and he spared Agag. Agag, in a sense, could be part of the plunder. And so the mistake that cost Saul his kingship here
is
reversed. So Esther, the descendant of Saul, now presumably has informed everybody. Everybody seems to know the original battle with Amalek, and so they will wipe out enemies, but they won't touch the plunder.
You think they knew that? They knew the history, so therefore they didn't.
That's right.
The way the author portrays it.
That's certainly how Esther is being written, is assuming that everybody knows, and so they're not going to touch the plunder. And so in this way they redeem.
It's interesting, it's like learning, you know, one thing we learn from history is we don't learn from history, it's what the phrase is. But in this case, the one thing they learned from their history is that they did learn, if you kill the guy, the bad guy, mm-hmm. and you don't take the plunder.
In a sense, also, by not taking the plunder, it's proving that this is not a personal thing. It's not a battle we initiated. We're interpreting this battle as a battle of God, like you say, going back to this original attack. We didn't ask for it. They're attacking us. Therefore, they are Amalek.
Right.
They're attacking without reason. And so we're going to treat them like Amalek. Yeah. We're going to wipe out the attackers, but we're not going to plunder them. And that's to show, like most times in war, of course you take the plunder. It's the good stuff. Why would you leave that?
And many times you did, too.
And it's to show that this is a different category. This is not just us trying to take advantage of people. This is us simply acknowledging that these are attackers for no reason. And they're in the spirit of Amalek attacking us. And so we have an injunction to wipe them out. Notice also that Haman gets hung, and his, how many sons?
Ten.
10 sons. So finally, we get a little bit of justice with the Agagite descendant being wiped out and his sons. So if we take the memory of Amalek is the progeny, then you'd have to wipe out the sons. And if we parallel that back to Israel's first king, when Saul dies, there's a battle, and he dies, and who else? How many? 3. 3 die with him in battle. But then, so that's not an exact parallel, right? Because we have Haman and 10 sons, Saul and 3 sons. And they get skewered, remember? They get skewered and put up on display to say, hey, we beat the king of Israel. But then in the future, the Gibeonites come to David and ask to hang up 7 descendants of Saul. Remember the story? And they also skewer them and hang them up. And so you have 7, and you add on 3, and you get to 10. So you have the 7 Saul and his sons' descendants mirrored by Haman and his 10 sons that get impaled. And then there's a one last point I'll make really quickly before we go downstairs. Back to verse 16 of Exodus. There is another interpretation that we find in the Greek translation of this selection, which was done in 250 BC, roughly. And in the Greek translation, it says, for verse 16 of Exodus 17, for God, oh, for
a hidden hand. For by a hidden hand, God has war against Amalek from generation to generation. And hidden hand, of course, this is Greek. But if the Greeks were reading Hebrew, what could they have seen? There are several manuscripts, not too many, but a couple that have Yad Ksuya, presumably. There are a couple that have these two, the Ket Ya, put together as one word. So if you were to repoint it and make a word on the basis of an Aramaic word, you could get something like Ksuya, covered, hidden. And so by, instead of Hiyad Al, I guess you'd have to read Aliyad Ksuya. I don't know. No, it could be Hebrew too. It's just not the normal word you'd have for. Yeah. It's not a pied.
On what basis you said that Haman is a descendant of King Agag of Amalek?
Because it says he's an Agagi. Agagi. Agag. It's not so common in the Bible. There is one Agag, and he's king of Amalek. If you want to say that it's a common name, you'll have to prove that.
But you have to prove that. Why he didn't say descendant of Amalek?
Because. Why didn't he say Esther was praying to God? Because he's an artist, and he's exactly wanting you to read between the lines. The whole scroll of Esther, if you don't read between the lines, the book can't be in the Bible. Because there's no God, there's no prayer. There's a bunch of partying going on. There's a lot of dangerous stuff here. So if you're not willing to read between the lines, you better not read the book at all. Because the author is clearly inviting you to read between the lines.
There is nothing hidden in the Bible.
Oh, nothing?
Explained.
So then we know everything, I guess.
But
back to what is presented in the Septuagint then. This concept that by a hidden hand, God has war with Amalek. And so my idea is that the author of Esther not only is telling his story to show this continuation of the battle, but he's aware of that idea that it's hidden. There was no direct miracle, but the proof is in the pudding. Because they survived, we saw that it was God's work, and it's credited to God by Moses. And so with a hidden hand, God is at work against Amalek. And that fits very nicely into the fact that he doesn't ever once mention God.
Right.
And it is not by accident, because he leads you up. He even talks about fasting. And but no prayer. Like, he's on purpose. He's leading you there, and then he won't mention God. So he's trying to show you. He's highlighting the fact that he's not mentioning God. And I think this is because he views this whole battle to be secret. It's on a plane that you can't see with flesh and blood eyes. You have to believe it's going on. And you have to act, you have to initiate out of faith, like Esther does. And faith that Mordecai has, that, you know, help's going to come somewhere else if you don't do it. But then you're going to be wiped out. And so there's this whole idea that that the war with God is hidden, but it's going on. And you're still a part of it. You still have to act, but you have to enter in faith to do it. So we're out of time. I would normally invite comments, but we need to go downstairs because the service is already beginning. So Shabbat Shalom and Chag Purim Sameach.
Thank you.